Morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to Live Coffee, Free Association. It's Friday afternoon, just about 3 o'clock, 10 to 3. I'm in the Mile Castle, which is a Wetherspoons bar. But they do coffee for a pound, so that's the reason I'm here. But it's Friday afternoon, so it's probably the busiest bar around. And I've got bottomless coffee, so I'm not going to complain too much. I found a reasonably good corner. There's still Perspex screens up between the tables, which means there's a little bit of shielding for the noise, which makes this almost practical. But it's loose. I'm not planning anything. I'm just drinking my coffee and talking to myself, basically, until somebody comes in. I'm sure they will. I'll share this, so just see if there's anybody around. Alright, so that's shared to Twitter and Telegram. I'm not going to bother with Facebook because nobody ever shows up from Facebook, so it's a bit pointless. Not really my target audience. But I do have a few people on Podbean, a few people on Telegram, and a few people on Twitter who might show up. So that's good enough for me. As I say, it's loose. Nothing specific going on. I might play a video, in actual fact. Let me just have a look on library and stuff. I'm doing loose, so something on YouTube.
Hi, Don.
Hello. How are you doing?
Pretty good. About yourself?
I can't go.
Okay, this is Donald Huffman.
This is the right show. You're Donald Huffman at University of California at Irvine. You're a cognitive scientist at the University of titles like visual intelligence about the process of perception and seeing reality. What we're going to talk about today is kind of at the intersection of cognitive science and philosophy. We're going to talk about the mind-body problem, the question of what consciousness is, and a question that's raised by your particular theory of consciousness, which is, as far as I know, quite distinctive, unlike anything I've heard before. And that question is whether what we think we see is really real or how close to real it is. Your theory of consciousness, which has been getting attention among the people who think about these things, your theory suggests that things are not real as we think they are. This bottle of water, it's useful for me to think I see it, but it may not be. There are very close correspondence to the underlying reality, right?
It's real as an experience, but it may not exist apart from my experience in that form.
Right. Now, your theory builds on the following, I think, fact about natural selection. I don't think this is really disputed, which is to say that, strictly speaking, natural selection doesn't build a brain that sees the truth. I mean, that's not what the criterion of natural selection is. The criterion is natural selection will preserve traits that are conducive to the proliferation of genes. And so it will build brains that have the kinds of perceptions and thoughts that are conducive to the proliferation of genes. And if those perceptions and thoughts are false, but still are conducive James, then there will be false perceptions. I think that's actually uncontroversial, right, in evolutionary biology. And some kind of mundane reflections of that are well known. So, for example, if you imagine a species that grows up amid poisonous snakes, it would probably make sense when you're walking through the brush and there's anything that makes the kind of noise a snake makes, it probably makes sense to, like, get alarmed and even think you see a snake, even if nine times out of ten there is no snake, that still is on balance a healthy policy. And so that will lead to the actual illusion of snakes. You know, sometimes if you see a snake when it's just a lizard or something else. But natural selection favors that kind of perceptual bias because it helps you stay alive long enough to get your genes to the next generation. Now, that's a mundane reflection of this, and so too are a lot of famous optical illusions. Those are also reflections of this in ways I don't think we need to get into. But you're taking this kind of fact about natural selection and making a much deeper claim about its implications.
Yes.
For perception, right? Do you want to talk about that a little?
That's right. So the standard view in the field, I think, is the one that you just described, that of course, natural selection is, in the first instance, only about propagating the genes, propagating the species. And perceptions that do that are the ones that will survive. And I think nobody argues with that. But the assumption in the field has been that the perceptual strategies that will actually be favored by that kind of natural selection are perceptual strategies that see reality as it is. Now, not exhaustively. No one, very, very few people would claim that we see all of reality as it is. But that those aspects of the world that we do see accurately, and we see the ones that we need to survive and reproduce. And so the assumption has been that, therefore, that theoretical perceptions that are accurate to the state of the world, not exhaustively, but about those parts of the world that we need to know about, theoretical perceptions are the ones that are favored by natural selection. That's the textbook assumption, is the assumption by most researchers in the field. But it's an assumption that we don't have to just wave our hands about. We can actually go and check and prove this. Evolution is mathematically precise theory. We have the tools of evolutionary game theory, evolutionary graph theory, and evolutionary algorithms. We can actually go and ask, what does the mathematical theory of evolution do? What does it do to vertical perception? Does it favor them? Does it make them more likely? What does it drive them to extinction?
So can I just get clear on the terminology? In the example I gave, if it's a veridical perception in your terms, that would mean the snake is actually there. Veridical means accurately representing reality, right?
Exactly. And most people in the field, in the field of perceptual science, would say that there is a real three-dimensional world with physical objects like snakes in it.
Right.
And when you see a snake, or when you have the perceptual experience that you describe as a snake, that perceptual experience is a veridical representation of a true snake in objective reality that exists, whether or not you perceive
it. As a rule. Now, it is conventionally acknowledged that there are the exceptions, like where you think, oh, that's a snake, when there's not, because you err on the side of caution, and a few other examples like that. And maybe this is a good distinction to make. I mean, people agree that it will give rise, that the natural selection will create brains that give rise to the illusion of a snake in certain cases. But then often when you see a snake, the snake is really there. What you're saying is, no, the snake is not necessarily ever there in a sense.
That's right. So you're right. The standard assumption is that our perceptions are vertical under normal circumstances.
Right.
Of course, if you get someone in a psychologist's lab, all bets are off.
Right.
And there are rare circumstances where our perceptions will fail to be veridical. But the standard assumption is that under normal circumstances, we will see those aspects of reality accurately that we need to see accurately. And that was the assumption that I decided to test. And initially, I was skeptical about it because I thought, reality is pretty complicated. And there are all sorts of selection pressure to do things fast and cheap. And so maybe perceptual systems may not go after the vertical perceptions of the world simply because they're very expensive. And so that was my assumption going into it, that that might be the interesting result. But it turned out that that's true, that we try to do things faster or cheaper because, you know, every calorie you spend on perception is a calorie that you have to get some. I have to go out and kill something and eat it to get that calorie. And so other things being equal, we try to do things on the cheap and do them quickly. And that certainly turned out to be true in the Monte Carlo simulations that we ran of evolutionary game theory. But the deeper result that in retrospect I should have seen up front, but I didn't, was that fitness functions, which are the bread and butter of evolution, they're how you get your fitness points from your actions. Fitness functions are a function of the real state of the world, whatever that world might be. But they're not identical to the world. They're functions on the world. And the key idea is that fitness functions, we can talk in detail about what fitness functions are.
I don't think we probably need to. Let me make sure I understand. I mean, basically, I think you can do computer simulations of evolution, and you did computer simulations, which I gather showed what we just said, that when there's a difference between seeing things truly and seeing things that will get your genes into the next generation, whether or not they're really there, the perceptions of all over those that get your genes into the next generation, right?
Absolutely.
And I guess we needn't spend much time on this, but I have a kind of a question about that, which is, it's almost like, why you bother doing a simulation, since it's almost true by definition that natural selection has to choose between a true perception and a perception that gets genes in the next generation. The latter will be the perception that transpires, right? So it seems to me you could have just asserted that as something, as an axiom that's true by definition, and then gotten on with your philosophy, which we'll get on with shortly. But am I missing something as to why you actually need to do the simulations?
Pretty much the reason I did the simulations is because everybody else in the field that has been doing perceptual science actually stated in print pretty much that vertical perceptions were the ones that were more effective. So they understood that it's all about fitness, but then they conflated fitness with vertical perceptions. They said that if the reasons our perceptions are useful evolutionarily is because they're true.
Okay.
And it was that identification of the evolutionary usefulness of our perceptions with them being true that I wanted to test, because everybody was making that assumption. And there is just the fact that although fitness does depend on the state of the world, it's not the same thing as the state of the world. It's the way
to diverge. Nothing you need to convince the people who perhaps were not sufficiently steeped in the logic of natural selection and so you did a computer simulation. But in any event, let's accept stipulate the premise that non-veridical perceptions will prevail in natural selection if that's what gets genes into the next generation. And let's do what you do with that, which is to take it to a much kind of deeper level than I had seen it taken. And maybe you can explain to us your kind of desktop computer metaphor.
Yes.
What the relationship is between what we think is reality and actual reality.
Okay, very good. So the first thing I should say is that I'm not a so-called metaphysical solipsist, which is a person who claims that there's nothing that exists except for me and my perceptions. So I'm not a solipsist of that variety. I think that there is some kind of objective reality, and it'll exist whether or not I exist. And I have life insurance, so I'm putting my money where my mouth is. But the question is, if evolution has not shaped our perceptions to resemble that objective reality, it's just given us a set of symbols that are species-specific guides to keep us alive, then how should we understand the nature of those perceptions? Most people in perceptual psychology assume that what we're seeing just is the surface of objective reality in some sense. And evolution is very, very clear that that's not the case. So how should we think of our perceptions? And so the metaphor that I think is very, very helpful is the metaphor of the desktop interface on your computer. And suppose you have on your desktop an icon that's, say, blue and rectangular, and in the lower right-hand corner of the screen, and it's for, you know, say, an email message you're creating or a paper you're writing. You can ask yourself, if an icon is blue and rectangular, does that mean that the email message itself or the file that you're writing is blue and rectangular? And the answer is, of course not. That's silly. Anybody who thought that the color of the icons on the desktop or their shape or their position, in some sense, would meant to reflect the true colors and true shapes and positions of the file on the computer, that just misunderstands the whole point of the interface. The interface is there not to show you the complex reality of the computer, like the diodes and resistors and the voltages and the magnetic fields. It's not there to show you that. In fact, it's there behind that. We pay good money for the interface software because we don't want to know that stuff. It's irrelevant to what we really want to do, like sending emails, editing photos, and so forth.
Because it is for practical purposes, the more efficient description of reality. Just the icon is a more useful perception than to see a bunch of electrons bumping into each other on a circuit board or whatever.
That's
the underlying reality is, and as we said, natural selection will favor perceptions that are efficient in the sense of getting genes into the next generation.
Exactly. So the idea then is that natural selection has endowed us with a species-specific user interface. Space and time, the three dimensions of space as we perceive them, are the desktop. And physical objects are the icons.
Okay, so it isn't just objects that are in some sense not real. You're saying space-time is itself just a convenient projection. Now, you said species-specific. I would think that kind of all the species we're familiar with would find, well, they don't think about a space-time continuum, but they're, I would imagine that certainly dogs are seeing three dimensions and are, in some sense, implicitly assuming that some things come after others. I mean, is it species-specific, the projection of space-time, or is it just more like specific to life?
Well, there may be some aspects of the user interface that is common across some species, but I would imagine that E. coli, for example, doesn't have very much of a 3D representation of space, perhaps. I mean, it certainly is plausible to me that it might not. If it did, I would be interested to find out that it did, but it's certainly at least reasonable to me to think that it doesn't. And so I don't want to take any aspect of the human perceptual system, the human species-specific interface, as necessarily true of any other species. I think we need to look case by case and see what evidence we might have that the interfaces of other species are like our own.
Okay.
Even within Homo sapiens, there are mutations, and it's not at all clear that your interface is exactly the same as mine. I would think that they're relatively similar, and that's what we can communicate pretty well, but they're, you know, evolution is continuing, and so your interface is probably a little bit different from mine. So even when I speak about a species-specific interface, I'm being a little bit loose there because your interface is not exactly the same as mine.
So let me try to pursue a kind of a computer-like analogy a little. It's a little bit like, I guess the question is, the question will naturally occur to people is, well, what is the real world like then, and what is the real world? You do refer to a world, and I'd be tempted to say on the basis of your metaphor that, okay, reality is as different from what we perceive as a bunch of electrons bumping into each other on a circuit board and moving in certain patterns are different from file folders on our computer. But I actually think your theory is a little weirder than that, in a sense. When I've heard you describe what you think the world is, it's not as straightforward an extension of that analogy as I might have hoped. You know what I mean? Right. And I would assume that at this point, a lot of people start having trouble wrapping their minds around things. Do you want to talk a little about, like, if I ask you the question, okay, what is reality like? I mean, if the analogy, in a certain sense, is kind of like, I'm a creature in a video game like Pac-Man or some newer video game, running around the screen, seeming to see things and responding to obstacles by moving around them, but in fact, those obstacles are illusory, they're just pixels, and really the action is being governed by these electrons on the circuit board. I mean, it's my temptation to think of it that way, but I actually think things, in your view, are weird, right?
That's right. So the starting point is the recognition that the very language of our perceptions of space and time and physical objects with matter and shapes and colors and so forth, that very language has been shaped by natural selection simply to keep us alive, not to tell us anything about the nature of objective reality as it is. So there's no reason to believe that any of that language, any of the predicates of that language, and anything that can be described in that language is going to be the nature of the objective world. And that's pretty strong. What that means is that whatever objective reality is, the chances that thinking about it in terms of space and time and matter and physical objects and colors and shapes is just the wrong language. You'll get nowhere. The analogy would be, suppose I said, I would like you to tell me a detailed theory of the inner workings of a computer, but the only language I'm going to let you use is the language of the pixels on your desktop. So you have positions and colors of pixels. That's your language. Go for it. Try as best you can to describe how a computer works. Good luck. I've made it impossible for you because I've given you a language that's not the right language to do the job. And so that's the same problem that we have when we start trying to think of using the language of space and time and position, momentum, spin, shape, mass, matter to describe the objective reality. Where we've given ourselves an impossible task, just like asking ourselves to describe a computer just based on the pixels on the desktop. So what we have to do is to be willing to let go altogether of some very deeply held beliefs that there's any resemblance whatsoever between the nature of our perceptions and even the language of our perceptions and the nature of objective reality. That's a very, very difficult position for us to take. We seem to be very, very wedded to the idea that our perceptions are giving us some kind of insight into the nature of reality. At least the language of our perceptions is the right language to describe reality. And that's what I'm saying we need to call into question.
And by the way, one of the things you're calling into question, I'm not sure if you mentioned this in your list, but is causality itself. So,
absolutely.
If you see billiard balls bumping into each other on a computer and it looks like the ball is causing the other ball to move, well, you know that's not really happening on your computer screen. There's not causality happening on the screen. Rather, they're both just behaving in accordance with the script. You're saying the causality, we think, and this has been suggested by philosophers like Hume and so on, that we can't really confidently infer actual causality. We never really know more than that certain things regularly precede other certain things, and so on. We never know for sure that causality per se happens. Anyway, that's another weird thing about your
That's right. So I don't necessarily need to give up the notion of causality of some kind of entities. I'm happy to contemplate the idea that the notion of causality itself is not a fiction, but that the specific causality that we all know and love, namely that a physical object like a billiard ball hitting another billiard ball and making it move, that that's genuine causality. That I think we will have to give up. So when one, you know, the eight ball hits, the white ball hits the eight ball into the corner pocket, we can say that the cue ball caused the eight ball to move. And for practical purposes, that's fine. It's a useful fiction, but strictly speaking, it's a fiction. There is perhaps some causal sequence going on in the objective world, yet all I can do as a humble member of the species Homo sapiens is to represent it in terms of a cue ball hitting an eight ball and having a fiction of a causal interaction between those two.
And by the way, in some scenarios where causality is an illusion, people are actually talking about a completely deterministic universe. So what they're really doing is just watching a movie, and everything has been prescribed from the beginning. And the idea of like causality is, well, yours is not necessarily, as I understand it, a completely determined universe. At least you use terms like choice in your theory, which we'll get into in a little. Right. So you're not talking about a deterministic universe necessarily.
Not necessarily a deterministic universe. And I should point out that there are the theory that I'm working here is two separate aspects, and that one could buy the one and not the other. So the first aspect that I'm fairly confident about is that evolution entails that we almost surely do not see reality as it is. That I'm pretty confident. If you buy evolution, then I think that you have to buy the conclusion that space and time and physical objects are a species-specific desktop and not a depiction of reality. Now, once you've bought that, there's, you know, we have to give up our, you know, our dearly loved theory that reality resembles what we perceive. That's hard to give up. So that I think, disqualifies evolution. The next step is to ask, what theory of reality shall we propose? And there's an infinite number of possibilities, right? We've thrown away one theory, the one that we happen to like a lot, but it's just one out of an infinite number of possibilities. So when I go and propose a specific new theory, I'm probably wrong. There's a lot of options out there. So that's going to be a far more, you know, problematic direction in terms of, you know, how confident I am. So I do have a theory, and I can discuss the theory with you, but I should point out that theory is separate from the evolutionary conclusion.
Okay.
The evolutionary conclusion is we don't see reality as it is. The second step is, okay, now as scientific theorists, what shall we propose as a new theory of that reality? Someone could buy my first proposal that we don't see reality as it is, and not buy my proposal about the nature of reality that I'm going to propose.
In the proposals you have, there's an actual mathematical version of it. I think it has maybe 7 variables or something like that, and we won't be able to get into that in any depth at all, but one interesting feature of it is I think you claim it's testable.
Right.
And so we'll talk about that. Now, before we get into that, I want to get a little more deeply into the question of, okay, if this is not the real world, what is the real world that this is a kind of, in a certain sense, a reflection of, or bears a certain kind of correspondence to? And here's where things get weirder, as if things weren't weird enough. I at least by my reckoning, as I understand it, the world, is it that it's kind of created by conscious agents you tell me, you refer in your theory to conscious agents, and I'm not sure if you, does a conscious agent correspond to what we would think of as a conscious, like I'm a conscious agent, you're a conscious agent, like, so right now we are two conscious agents interacting, is that the correct terminology in your theory?
Yes, to the first, there's the first step, yes, but there's more to it. So I'll unpack it just a little bit. So here's the motivation for the direction I've gone. The idea is, it may be the case that all of my beliefs are false. I may know nothing, and that's a serious possibility. There's, you know, as scientists, we have to acknowledge that possibility. But if there is anything that I believe that's true, it's that I do have conscious experiences. And if I believe that I'm, you know, feeling a pain or smelling a rose or tasting chocolate, if my belief that I'm having an experience is wrong, then I'm pretty much wrong about everything, and we might as well just eat, drink, and be merry, because it's, you know, there's really nothing else that we can do as scientists.
This is a little like what Descartes said. The minimalist assumption is that you are having this experience whether or not the experience is true.
That's right. I don't want to, therefore, go to the, you know, the coach to ergo sum kind of thing. You know, I don't want to perhaps go where it goes in terms of trying to prove my own existence, but just merely that if I'm wrong that there are experiences, then pretty much there's not anything secure that I can go with. So I decided to say, okay, let's go with that. If space and time and matter, which are just my reality. And I can't let go of the idea that I have consciousness experiences. Let's just start with consciousness. Let's see if we can get a mathematical theory of consciousness and conscious experiences, but a new kind of theory. I mean, there are many cognitive neuroscientists and philosophers who are trying to get a theory of consciousness, but the typical approach is to say, let's start with brain activity and say that this kind of brain activity or this pattern of brain activity is consciousness or gives rise to consciousness. So consciousness is secondary to some physical description of the brain or microtubules in the brain or retrosomal cortical loops in the brain or something like that. And I'm saying, let's not start with our interface of space and time. Let's start with the description of consciousness on its own terms. So what do we mean by consciousness? Not as, you know, inhabiting space and time, because we don't know that it inhabits space and time. We just want its own properties on its own. So the idea is that there are conscious experiences and there are actions that you can take based on those conscious experiences, where the you is used in a more generic sense, not you as a person, but, you know, consciousness itself. And then there is some kind of notion of a choice of the action that you're going to take based on your conscious experiences. And then those actions have an effect on the objective reality, whatever it is. And that objective reality, in turn, affects your conscious experience. Those are the key ingredients that I put together into a very, very simple mathematical formula.
And those things, you kind of have to stick with those premises if you're going to remain within the framework of natural selection, which is the basis of your whole theory anyway. I mean, there have to be these discrete entities, which we call organisms. That's what they look like to us, whatever they may be at the deepest level. These discrete things that act on the world based on their experiences. And so you're sticking with that at an abstract level, those premises of natural selection. But beyond that, lies the weirdness. So go ahead.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with what you're saying, and it is actually in accord with what Dawkins and Dennett called universal Darwinism, the key algorithmic principles underlying Darwinian evolution of replication, retention, and selection. And
variation.
Variation. That's right. So the idea was, and that's what evolutionary game theory is based on, is that it's essentially a mathematical representation of universal Darwinism. But what it does allow you to do is to think about biological evolution without some of the physicalist assumptions that are usually made as well. So that organisms are real physical objects in 3D space, and DNA is a physical thing that exists in space and time. We don't need to have those assumptions. In fact, what evolutionary game theory suggests is that those assumptions are actually false. So that we have to rethink Darwinian evolution based on evolutionary game theory itself. But you're right that the theory of conscious agents does still keep the core of Darwinian evolution in terms of the universal Darwinism aspect of it. Absolutely.
Okay. And there is this idea of discrete conscious entities or discrete packages of consciousness. That has to be preserved too, right? I mean,
yes.
Consciousness can't just be this undifferentiated mass, universal mass. There have to be discrete incarnations of different, you know what I mean? Right. And your theory calls for there to be more than one conscious agent.
Absolutely. And in fact, perhaps an infinite lattice of them, from the very, very simple to the very, very complex. And it turns out the formalism, so it allows for conscious agents, and there's a formal definition of conscious agents, so anything that satisfies that definition is a conscious agent according to the theory. And they can go all the way from the simplest ones, which have only one bit of experience, literally, essentially one bit of possible experiences and one bit of possible actions, all the way up to, a countable infinity of
so the first case is strictly hypothetical. It's not like you think that there is some organism out there that has only two options in terms of consciousness, right?
Well, my theory forces me to entertain that possibility and to imagine consciousnesses that are brain in some sense.
Oh, I see. So consciousness may go beyond the organic world in your...
Well, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. In fact,
so what we call a proton, which of course is not anything like what we conceive it to be in your theory, but whatever it is, it could have consciousness. So this is kind of like what's called panpsychism, which is that everything in the universe is...
It's not panpsychism, but that's a very important distinction. So panpsychism, for example, with respect to electrons and photons, is the idea that electrons, in addition to their physical properties, like position, momentum, and spin, and so forth, also have consciousness properties. But I'm denying that there is such a thing in objective reality as an electron with position. Right, I'm saying that the very framework of space and time and matter and spin is the wrong framework, it's the wrong language to describe reality. So I'm in some sense more radical than panpsychism. Panpsychism is almost a dualist in the way I'm formulating it. There are physical objects, like electrons, and in addition to their physical properties, they have these consciousness properties. I'm saying let's go all the way, it's consciousness and only consciousness all the way down.
So, but it's not a pure idealism, as I think you know, like Berkeley or whoever, right?
For Berkeley to be is to be perceived, but the conscious agents are perceivers, and they could be without being perceived. They might be inert, but their existence is not dependent on being perceived. My view has a higher affinity with idealism than with panpsychism, but it's one difference. There's a couple differences. First, I like to call my point of view conscious realism, because I want to say that it's often been put out as realism versus idealism, and I think that's it's just the wrong way to frame the thing. I'm realist about consciousness. Others are realist about physical reality. I'm not realist about physical reality. I think that it's part of the user interface of consciousness. But I am very realist about conscious experiences and conscious choices and so forth. So I call it conscious realism. The nature of objective reality is consciousness that can be described mathematically. Now, for me then, to solve the mind-body problem, I have to solve it in a different way than everybody else is trying to solve it. Right? Most people, 99% of the researchers trying to solve the mind-body problem are starting with the physical reality, in particular, brain states, brain activity, and they have to show how consciousness might arise from that or be identical to that. I have to go the other direction. I start with the mathematical theory of consciousness completely independent of any notion of space, time, or matter. Completely independent. And it's my burden, then, to say that this mathematical model of consciousness can give rise to all of the modern mathematics of, say, quantum mechanics and general relativity.
Okay.
So if I cannot derive from the theory of conscious agents, first, what we already know about quantum field theory, gravity, and then hopefully a new theory of quantum gravity itself, then I'm wrong. This is just that simple.
So there can be conscious agents that not only don't correspond to electrons, there can be conscious agents that don't correspond to any of the physical phenomena we currently describe as part of a scientific framework. Is that right? Correspond to protons or anything else.
Absolutely.
Is it just that we science hasn't yet discovered the physical phenomena that would correspond to the conscious agents? You're saying that in this sense, conscious agents just are more fundamental than what we refer to as the physical world.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So first came the conscious agents, and then came the physical world. But see, this is where I get a little caught up in the chicken and egg problem when I start putting this in terms of natural selection, right? I mean, for natural selection to happen, as we conventionally conceive of it, you've got these conscious agents. I mean, we assume that they're conscious, but anyway, we've got these agents. And then you've got this, world for them to respond to. And it's true that the world consists partly of each other. Bacteria respond partly to each other. But in the first first instance, when the first self-replicating form of organic life came into being, it was responding strictly to a physical. So it's like the physical world, which we normally conceive of as unconscious, was a given. And then self-replicating things came along and started responding to it. So in the conventional reckoning, you just have this dichotomy. Now, I recognize that dichotomy in a way rests on the assumption that what we refer to as the inorganic world is not conscious, and you would take issue with that assumption. So still, I can't be alone in having trouble, like, wrapping my mind around this whole thing and kind of vaguely perceiving a kind of chicken and egg problem, right? Even you must have this problem a little, right?
Yes, because, you know, like everybody else, I am, you know, naturally a physicalist and a naive realist. I believe whatever I'm not thinking carefully, I always believe just naturally that I'm seeing reality as it is. That's just sort of the way we've evolved. And so it's very, very difficult to step outside of that when evolution itself forces me to take that idea seriously. But the idea is that when I interact with something that to me looks inanimate, like a rock, it doesn't look living to me. And so I'm not saying that the rock itself is conscious, but that the rock itself is a symbol that I'm using to represent a reality that is completely unlike a rock. A reality that is not in space and time, and a reality that is in itself a potentially infinitely complex interaction of conscious agents. But because I have
the reality itself is an interaction of conscious agents.
Yeah,
so you mean including you or not necessarily including you?
I'm certainly interacting with it. So yes.
But I mean, before you started interacting with it, I mean, you would say, I guess, if it exists in itself, then it itself has to be an interaction of conscious agents.
Exactly right. That's the ontology I'm proposing here.
All right, I've got to stop that there because I need another cup of coffee. I can't walk across the bar to get my next cup of coffee and listen to Donald Hoffman at the same time. But I think that's a good place to stop. I don't know how far in we are. We're about 40 minutes in, just over. So I'm gonna close up there. Thanks for coming in. 100-yard archivist has been here more or less the whole time. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate your interest in what I'm doing. I know you're around on a fairly regular basis, so I do appreciate that, man. Do appreciate it. All right. Now we've got somebody else come in, and I've got to go and get a cup of coffee, but I will. May as well keep the room open as there's people coming in. So I've just changed my mind completely. No, I haven't, because she's bounced out. Julie. She's just bounced out. So, I will close the room. I might be back later on today. In fact, I probably will be back later on today because I'm in that kind of mode. Alright, I'll see you a bit later on. Take care, man.